Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
North Korea has confirmed that it detonated a thermonuclear device. And of course, you've got to look at other evidence as well. So the US Geological Survey estimated that the tremor that was set off by a blast detected in the northwest of North Korea had a magnitude of 6.3. You know, that'd be a moderately powerful earthquake. South Korea's defense ministry, their estimate was a little lower at 5.7, but even at that level, that's a blast something like 5 to 6 times as powerful as their last nuclear test, which was a year ago. So there's a blast followed by a tremor and then a second tremor, which the US Geological Survey called a collapse. Now, today's explosion follows on the very provocative actions during the last week of firing a missile over Japanese territory. And yes, there have been provocative actions on the other side as well. Sorties flown near the demilitarized zone by American fighter jets. To help us analyze just where we all stand with this and what the next steps might be, we go once again to John Blaxland of the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre at the ANU. Professor Blaxland, welcome back to Open House.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, it used to be the case that all the bluster from North Korea couldn't be believed, but for me, one of the most disturbing things of the last few weeks is that whenever he says he's going to do something, he does it.
It is quite extraordinary. He has clearly ratcheted up the nuclear developments program and the ballistic missile program to a level that pundits had just not envisaged. And so we are really seeing the North Koreans get to the point where they probably, where Kim Jong-un might actually finally be comfortable that he won't face that existential threat that brought about the demise of Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein. That's essentially what we're talking about here. This is his guarantee of survival.
Now, so your theory, which we've aired, been grateful to air on this program on a number of occasions, and many people find it compelling, is that once he's demonstrated that he does have nuclear capacity, then he'll have what he needs to be able to sit down at a bargaining table and face off against a nuclear power like the United States.
Yes. And that's exactly what I believe he wants, which is to sit down with Trump from a position of strength and negotiate, be it the finalisation of a peace treaty or some deal which sees America concede ground and North Korea give very little, except some guarantees. So he's in a very strong position. And unfortunately, the United States, the West, China and others have very little bargaining power. Mm. Now you'd think, okay, hang on, what about China? Don't they? Well, yes, they've got an on-off switch. They could turn off North Korea, effectively, but that would leave China with an implosion that would be catastrophic and likely would see the South Koreans, with the Americans alongside, right up on the Yalu River on the Chinese border, and that is just completely and utterly intolerable for China. That's just absolutely anathema. So that prospect is not on the cards. And so while China has signed up to the UN Security Council resolutions with sanctions alongside Russia, which is really quite extraordinary, in sanctioning North Korea, The question is how much resolve will China have to follow through on that, given that it's really not in its interests for North Korea to completely implode. Yes, they're keen for him to back down a bit, But they recognise his own internal logic and rationale for holding on to what he's got.
Well, if China's a little bit neutered, it's odd because the West keeps putting pressure on China. I guess they've got to do that, but is that also just for diplomacy reasons?
Oh, no, I think the pressure on China is real. I think it's for strategic reasons.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it's well enough thought through, though. My sense is that, and as I say, China's got very good reasons not to press too hard. So Trump's pressure on China to act, I think he's put too many eggs in that basket. I don't think that it's realistic to expect China to do all that much. Certainly, oil is being talked about. It was talked about a couple of days ago as being a possible additional sanction. Well, that would be like turning off the switch for North Korea, because that's essentially, as we get into autumn and then into winter, not having oil would see millions of people die being frozen.
So we come back to what we might call Plan A, or at least Scenario A, the one in which Kim Jong-un Un has enough to get himself a seat at the table. And you said earlier, negotiate a peace treaty. People might say, peace for what? But in fact, he's still prosecuting the Korean War. So it's peace for the Korean War.
Indeed.
And then there's a question of sanctions, and then there's the activity on the around the Korean Peninsula with the war games that the United States is waging. So there are a few things on the table.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, would... who's the next move up to in that scenario? Does he now have to put a hydrogen bomb on a missile and fire it off before he thinks that he's got enough leverage, or before indeed the West thinks he's got enough, that they need to sit down with him?
Yeah, look, I think for him to actually fire off an ICBM with a hydrogen bomb on it would be catastrophic. He knows that would be across the red line. So I don't think he needs to go there. He just needs to be in a position where he's confident that the testing is robust and rigorous enough to have demonstrated, in theory at least, convincingly, that the thermonuclear warhead on the ICBM works. And he's not there yet, I don't believe, but he's probably not far off. That's what's quite a scary thought. And, of course, we know that we're hearing from the United States rhetoric that has a parallel to the rhetoric out of North Korea, which is it's an escalatory rhetoric. Mm. Now, in the past, the United States has, in circumstances like this, looked to de-escalate. We're not seeing that from Trump at the moment.
No.
So the risk here is that the escalatory rhetoric will actually generate the momentum for action that actually triggers, the domino effect of escalation. And there is a real prospect of that. It's greater today than it's probably been, as I say, since 1962.
I am horrified to hear you use those words, domino effect, but I guess we need to take it seriously. Can we talk through a couple of scenarios? If one side or the other fired a weapon, what would happen next? Is it something that would be over in a very short space of time?
Well, in the past, North Koreans have done that very act. They've sunk ships. They've fired at missiles and artillery at South Korean bases and small islands. They've conducted cross DMZ raids. They've executed people. But South Koreans, the United States, have acted with incredible restraint and not responded in kind. They haven't gone tit for tat. It's not at all clear that the Trump administration would be able to hold itself back from undertaking that kind of tit for tat. And that is where you start the dominoes. The risk is that an attack on, say, here's a couple of hypotheticals. We heard just the other day, the B-1s and the F-15s and a number of F-35s flew along the DMZ, along the demilitarized zone just south of the DMZ.
And they fired some missiles of their own into
designated firing areas.
Yeah.
Military set aside training area sites where explosives are known to be used. But that's short of the DMZ. If they were to go across, conduct a run north of that line, or conduct a missile firing, or actually sink something, or attack the launch pad of the ICBMs, or attack the site of the weapons testing,
yes.
That would be, that may well be in Trump's mind. A ratcheted escalation, that's a measured escalation.
What's the kind of thing he was doing in Syria just a couple of months ago?
Exactly, striking at the airbase.
Hmm.
Now, that worked in Syria because the Syrians don't have nukes, and the Russians weren't going to use it against them because their interests weren't that great in Syria. All they wanted to do there was to protect their port bases on the Mediterranean coast, and they've secured them now. For a long time, they've got a great new deal with Bashar al-Assad, so that's all safe. The equation in North Korea is very different. So any kind of escalation like that, as tempting and as attractive as it might be for Trump to strike out, do something to punish Kim Jong-un, it's the fear of escalation. Kim Jong-un then retaliating, firing a barrage across into Seoul, or doing something like that, that could then, where do you stop? That's not clear. Under Obama, it was probably clearer. Under Trump, I think it's not quite as clear.
Yes. Our guest on Open House, Professor John Blaxland of Australian National University. In those circumstances, then, would the US missile defence system work? So that's a question. And if it didn't, what happens next? Because you would see a lot of people killed and injured in a very short space of time.
Well, look, the US and now Japanese ballistic missile defence system is a layered one, and it's incomplete. So there are aspects of it that are incredibly sophisticated, but essentially there are multiple components. You need to have very, very good radars. They need to be able to spot the launch, and that's one of the reasons why the THAADs are in Korea, because they have very good radars to do that, and that's what the Chinese are complaining about. And, of course, the Chinese know that it's not at all unreasonable for South Korea to want that so that they can have some early warning of a ballistic missile coming,
yes.
of a ballistic missile launch. So there's that, but then there's while the missile is going up to the apex before it comes down, in that space, while it's actually in space, there's very few options other than firing missiles from the air warfare destroyers, which are the SM-3 missiles. They're very good, but you have to be at the right place broadly. It can cover a bigger area, but you have to have air warfare destroyers, you know, stationed on essentially on a picket line,
right.
in the Sea of Japan somewhere to operate, to interdict. And of course, if that fails, if you haven't got that air warfare destroyer in the being able to interdict, then you need something like the Patriot at the other end to do that at the terminal phase to catch the missile as it's coming to Earth. But it's coming at, you know, what, at Mach 21?
Yeah.
It's incredibly fast. So,
well, and presumably even then you've got fallout effects and all kinds of other things.
Yeah, it's seriously risky. So that's why this is what Japan's been working on, a layered defence of having all of those options. That's why Korea's interested as well. Now, the Japanese are now, of course, buying more of this stuff because they know that Kim Jong-un is up for using them against Japan. Yeah. And even if he's deliberately trying to go over Japan, all it takes is a mistake and it lands on Japan. Well, you know, that's intolerable. So we are now looking, and this is something interesting for Australia. We have got air warfare destroyers coming online, but they're not BMD capable. And there's a question to be asked there. Well, look, in this day and age, isn't that kind of a baseline requirement to be able to operate in that space? This is not a unique capability to Korea. The countries with ballistic missiles, or with intercontinental ballistic missiles, can launch that kind of thing. My sense is we should be having a long, hard look and thinking about what we put on our air warfare destroyers to make sure that we can plan that game too, in the defensive capability.
Indeed. Probably a question for the medium term and not the short term. I wonder, John Blaxland, in the short term, if in the event there was a conflict in that area, on the Korean Peninsula and surrounds, could there be other consequential effects? Could other countries take that opportunity to conduct other actions of their own? Are we in a situation where we might see a World War II-like escalation? I don't want to be alarmist. Yeah, but
No, Stephen, I mean, you're right. And look, my colleague at the Strategic and Defence Studies Centre, retired Admiral Chris Barry, has been talking about us sleepwalking into war. I wrote a piece some months ago now about 7 reasons why we may be heading to war. That was actually a little bit before Trump got elected. Mm. But there is growing concern about indicators of the world going in a very dangerous trajectory. And of course, we know that with the former Soviet Union, Russia has a stake in this as well. Russia is a neighbour of North Korea.
Mm.
But Russia, of course, it goes right across the Eurasian landmass and has considerable interests and rub points with NATO in the Baltic areas. And that's so, you know, there is a question of, much like in the Second World War, where when one's down and tied up with one conflict, it's the perfect opportunity to exploit that and seize terrain or undertake other operations elsewhere. Now, that is a grave prospect. I remain sanguine that clever people in office in the United States, in Australia, in Russia, in China and beyond are sanely considering the calculus of that prospect and looking to avoid it. But it is closer than it's ever been.
My goodness. Well, John Blaxland, this is a program that likes to look to hope, as you know. What should we be hoping for? Where does hope lie, and what should we be praying for?
Look, I think we should be hoping for a recognition from the United States that North Korea is now a nuclear weapons state, and we should just get over it. And much like, you know, to mimic or to take at liberty with this Kubrick film, we need to learn to stop worrying and learn to love the North Korean bomb.
Because it may be actually the best things that stands between us and a conflict.
It's the best of a worst set of options. So the bottom line is, I'm quite confident that the North Koreans have no plan to use it in war, except in retaliation. And so the key is to avoid having them believe that they need to retaliate. This is because he knows, Kim Jong-un knows, that if he uses it, it's existential. The Americans would retaliate with massive overpower. And so this guaranteeing his longevity, as I say, with Mama Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein very much in the back of his mind, as seeking to avoid their fate.
He's built himself a very big bargaining chip, and it made a very big bang. Well, thank you once again for speaking with us. We do appreciate your analysis.
Thanks for having me on the program, Steve.
John Blaxland, the head of the Strategic Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. Yes, that bargaining chip built by Kim Jong-un and his regime, a big bang indeed, something between 5.7 and 6.3 on the Richter scale, with a secondary effect that they said was a collapse. Now that he's demonstrated the capacity to do that, is that enough to sit put and wait for some people to see a different way forward and to sit down and talk with him? That's what John Blaxland is putting his hopes on, and certainly well worth praying for wisdom to prevail in this situation.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.